This is Robert Hannon, the host of Northern Soundings. The political discussion in this episode was recorded before the events surrounding COVID-19 dramatically altered our social landscape. While sections of the conversation remain relevant, especially the examination of a two-party system, others have been superseded by events. In-person voting in the Democratic primary in Alaska won't take place on April 4th, but mail-in voting has been extended to April 10th. Also, the studio at KUAC, where Alexander Hirsch, Nate Bauer, and I record, now has restricted access. I'm crossing my fingers we'll be back with more timely analysis in April. Thanks, as always, for listening to the show. Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. When it comes to politics, the U.S. seems bipolar.
You know, the two-party system, it's not in our Constitution. It's not there. And you do hear critics now and again, this comes up. You know, why can't we have a spectrum of ideologies and a spectrum of parties? And it puts these candidates who are running for office now, both Republicans and Democrats, in an awkward position.
Political analysis with Alexander Hirsch and Nate Bauer. And geographer Carrie DeWitt discusses the fraught relationship between Iran and the United States.
There's a really interesting character in here. He was head of that branch of the CIA that dealt with things in the Middle East. And his name was Kermit Roosevelt, grandson of Theodore. And he looks completely harmless, but he was an amazing spy. And some people think that James Bond was partially based on him, actually.
And Chris Lott examines where we get the words bikini and tuxedo. I hope you'll stay around. Every month, I check in with political mavens Alexander Hirsch, UAF Professor of Political Science, and Nate Bauer, Director of the UA Press. They're looking at the 2020 presidential race from an Alaskan perspective. It won't come as a surprise, the political landscape has completely transformed since their last visit.
Super Tuesday, I think, was the big precipitating factor. The state of the race, I think, now and probably for the rest of the primary season will be that it's a two-person race on the Democratic side between Vice President, former Vice President Joe Biden and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
I would say Super Tuesday precipitated a paradigm shift in the Democratic primary. But even before that, actually, the James Clyburn endorsement of Joe Biden ahead of the South Carolina primary, that's actually the pivot point of 2020. Insofar as it was anticipated that Joe Biden, you know, was most likely to win in the South Carolina primary, but he didn't just win there, he dominated there. Mm. And according to most exit polls, a lot of voters, primary voters, Democratic primary voters in South Carolina cited the James Clyburn endorsement. He's the House Majority Whip. He's a representative from, you know, Sumter, South Carolina, and he has a lot of persuasive power amongst, in particular, black voters from that state. And Biden dominated that state, and I think as a result was able to consolidate the moderate lane. I mean, you saw suddenly Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar fall away. You know, their campaigns came to a close ahead of Super Tuesday, just a couple of days later, and they endorsed Biden. And I would say as a direct result, now Joe Biden is much, much more likely to win a majority of delegates than anyone else, and in particular over Bernie Sanders.
Well, okay. I will buy that Jim Clyburn, that endorsement mattered more than most endorsements. I think that the narrative around endorsements over the last few cycles has been that endorsements don't matter that much. They don't matter as much as maybe they used to, or we assume that they do. I think that they make a little bit of news, especially in sort of regional newspapers and so forth. I will buy that in this case, that one had more of an effect than usual. I also think, however, that the polling numbers in South Carolina had begun to shift pretty dramatically before Mayor Buttigieg and Senator Klobuchar dropped out, before the Clyburn endorsement actually happened. So it seems to me that there were a lot of factors that led to, you're right, that Joe Biden won by like 30 points.
Yeah.
I mean, it was remarkable. I think that people saw Bernie Sanders kind of taking over the lead. And I think that for not just the party establishment, but for maybe a lot of voters who consider themselves moderates or in the middle someplace, I think that, they were spooked. I think that they were spooked and surprised a little bit by Bernie Sanders, an avowed Democratic socialist, seeming like he had the inside track.
Which is curious because obviously lots of countries have democratic socialist governments. He points to Scandinavian countries as examples of his model. Why does it strike such fear in American voters?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think one reason is that most Americans don't know a lot about socialism. I think that it occupies a kind of symbolic space within the American public consciousness and has ever since the Red Scare and arguably before as sort of this, you know, ominous force that is un-American, you know, is deeply un-American. Not many Americans have read the Communist Manifesto, for instance, right? They're not very familiar with the political ideology or with the philosophical concepts that are embedded within it, but they know that it's the opposite of what American freedom looks like. I also think that there is, you know, maybe significant confusion about, for instance, the difference between the Venezuelan version of socialism and the Norwegian version of socialism. When Bernie Sanders is asked about, you know, his democratic socialism, he often says that his ideological role model is FDR, the New Deal. You know, that's the kind of democratic socialism he's interested in reviving in our political society. And so I think, you know, to some extent, I think that there's confusion about what this word means. And I certainly think that the specter of socialism did contribute to the DNC mobilizing ahead of Super Tuesday and voters becoming more compelled to vote for a perceived moderate in Joe Biden.
What was surprising to me, I sometimes make assumptions that people are real tuned in and dialed in on the days or the week's political news and who's even still in the race and what lanes, so to speak, they occupy. When a lot of polling data suggests, when I really look at it, that people are not always voting on, you know, specific policy details or even by ideological affiliations. I think that in many cases, especially this early in the general election process, they're voting based on demographics. They're voting based on a particular ad they saw that made a particular candidate look friendlier than the others. So anyway, my point is just that it was a little bit surprising to me that voters were able to coalesce around Joe Biden in South Carolina so effectively. I mean, to give him that big of
a win
and that quickly, like within a span of a few days.
The last time we spoke, ahead of the Nevada caucus, there was a debate. You mentioned earlier that to some extent there's been this idea that endorsements don't matter in primary elections. There's also an idea that debates don't matter in primary elections.
Right.
And I think both of those ideas have turned out to be wrong. To your point about how was Joe Biden able to strategically, efficiently, effectively, very quickly consolidate that middle lane, that moderate lane. How was he able to monopolize it so very swiftly? I think part of it had to do with Bloomberg. You know, last time we spoke, we thought Bloomberg might be a spoiler. There was a lot of people wondering whether or not the specter of the Bloomberg campaign was going to be really effective because he had this kind of unusual strategy of spending a lot of money. To date, I think he spent at least $600 million in advertising, and only in states, Super Tuesday states, that he thought were being ignored by the other Democratic candidates. That was his strategy, and no one knew whether or not it was going to pan out. Well, ahead of that Nevada caucus, what I remember is during that debate, certainly this was the media narrative, that Elizabeth Warren's attacks on Bloomberg were really effective.
Yeah.
It really rendered his campaign completely inviolable. And
his performance was really poor.
His performance was poor, I think proportionate, not having answers to the very difficult, challenging questions that she was posing to him. And, you know, you might say that there's an instance where the debates mattered a lot.
Yes. Again, I will buy that to some extent. But also, like, look at how many people watch the debates. Like, it's not that many.
The impact of the debate, it's not just from people who directly witnessed them. I think it has to do with the broader kind of resonating effect of people being aware generally aware, whether they watched the debates or not, that, for instance, you know, that Bloomberg did poorly. You know, that narrative, that story that was told about that event, I think that that has effects that are intangible and difficult to capture and quantify, but are nonetheless, I think, a part of the story of what has happened. You know, just taking stock of what has happened, I think it's important to just look at the way in which Warren has mattered a lot. And not only in terms of that Nevada debate, I think about Super Tuesday states where Biden overperformed his polling. And I would say there's three, arguably four, really, really important states to look at. Maine, Minnesota, Massachusetts, Texas. I think Texas is the biggest story coming out of Super Tuesday, and we should debate that. But Maine, Minnesota, Massachusetts, you look at those states, and if you were to pool all of the votes and the percentage of votes that Sanders and Warren each received, then either one of them would have outcompeted Biden in those states.
But why would you pool those together?
Well, I'm assuming that, and this is maybe an unfair assumption, but I'm assuming that because they have similar progressive ideological roots, that they have similar demographics of voters who are interested in voting for either. And that may be mistaken, but they are, you know, if lanes, I think lanes have to do with at least two things, identity and ideology. Their identities may be different, and there's reason to wonder about this, and we can debate this. But what is nonetheless true is that if you were to combine the percentage of votes that either of the two received in those three states, Maine, Minnesota, and Massachusetts, then whoever that you pulled those percentage of votes under, they would have easily beaten Joe Biden. But because they were split in that regard, Joe Biden, I mean, he won Massachusetts, for instance, I think with 33% of the vote.
Yeah.
And I mentioned this only because that was a surprise, right? That was him overperforming his polling and him kind of outperforming what was expected of him in that state and Minnesota and in Maine as well.
I think it's not safe to assume that Bernie Sanders would automatically be the second choice of Elizabeth Warren voters and vice versa. And I think there's actually polling data to suggest that if Elizabeth Warren had dropped out before Super Tuesday,
that's what I'm suggesting.
That her supporters would have been basically split between Biden and Sanders. If it had been a two-person race before Super Tuesday, I mean, that's a big hypothetical. Because even that's another polling question that people might answer in a strategic way. If they're a dialed-in, tuned-in voter, and you ask them, who's your second choice after your first choice candidate, people might choose to answer that question in weird ways.
That's UA Press's Nate Bauer and UAF Poli-Sci Professor Alexander Hirsch. We'll continue our discussion following this break. You're listening to Northern Soundings, and I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Welcome back. I'm talking this segment with Nate Bauer and Alexander Hirsch about the 2020 presidential race. Let's return to the conversation.
Help me out here. Candidates who represented something other than the two-party system fared well in American politics, whether on the right or the left. It seems like we have such a strong antipathy to a multi-party rather than just two-party system.
I think that goes way back. I think it goes way, way back to
Federalist, anti-federalist.
Founding of the country. I think that there were advocates and antagonists toward the Constitution, toward whether a particular state should sign the Constitution. The Federalists and the Anti-Federalists were effectively a two-party system back then. And, you know, there have been shifts and changes to the party system and what we call the different parties. But I think that the idea that there is a federal system of power, a federal government, and there is one component of our political system that is for that and the responsibilities and the powers that that federal government has, and there's another binary component that's against it, has basically been true since the founding of the country.
Yeah. How centralized or decentralized should authority and sovereignty and power be in our political society. And that debate does go back to, you know, James Madison versus Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah.
It's and to some degree the same debate that we'll hear going to the general election in the fall. Those debates will be about many things and about many specific policies, but I think just beneath the surface, you know, scratch just beneath the surface of the of those kind of policy prescriptions and you'll find core values that belong to one or the other camp about should authority be, where should sovereignty and power be in our political society? Should it be vested more in the hands of the people and more in local communities? Or should it be highly centralized in the federal government? And what role should the federal government play? What's appropriate for the federal government to play? But you're right. And, you know, the two-party system, it's not in our Constitution. It's not there. And you do hear critics now and again, this comes up. You know, why can't we have a spectrum of ideologies and a spectrum of parties? And it puts these candidates who are running for office now, both Republicans and Democrats, in an awkward position politically because they have to be representative of a big tent, right? They have to encompass and incorporate a lot of different political ideologies under their umbrella. And to do that and to do that well, very difficult because, of course, it's a whole ecology. It's a diverse field of interests and a diverse field of philosophical legacies and bring all those different groups together under a single heading. I think that's increasingly become the task of anyone who's going to be viable running for president.
Because effectively, we do have a big, wide spectrum of political beliefs and thoughts, and yet they are forced to identify their lane, so to speak, within whichever side of the aisle they're more closely affiliated. You know, this is like the idea that you have to tack real specifically in a primary and then get real broad in the general election. I think actually this year it's flipped a little bit. I think that there's been an incentive for the Democratic candidates in the primary to get pretty broad in order to secure the nomination. Yeah. And I think it's fair to presume that we might see some more specific ideology and maybe leftward shift in the general election.
We now have a Republican Party that rose for specific purposes to address certain historical conditions, but we don't have a Bull Moose Party, which also arose to address an issue, but didn't have the legs.
Right. I think if you look back over, I mean, even over recent history, I think you can find some third party efforts. And I mean, it's like a soap opera, honestly. You know, I think those come up because of personal vendettas. I mean, I think especially in regard to Teddy Roosevelt and the Bull Moose Party, I think that had quite a lot to do with his personal attitudes toward the Republican Party at the time and his successor, which he had a role in grooming. So there have been a number of times when a third party or an independent candidacy has made it all the way to the general election and has had arguably the effect of swinging it the other way. In the sense that, for example, the Bull Moose, Teddy Roosevelt, I think it's fair to assume looking back historically that the votes, or at least most of the votes that Teddy Roosevelt got as the Bull Moose candidate in 1912 would have gone to the Republican, to Taft. And because Teddy Roosevelt was well known and because he ran against the person that had been his vice president, he took votes away. But there are more recent examples too. Ross Perot, 1992, and
Ralph
96.
Nader.
Ralph Nader. Yeah, it's always hard to say what the results would have been had those people not been in the race. But I think it's compelling to look back at the history of the few times that these sort of insurgent campaigns have made it all the way to November.
I have a question for you, Nate.
Yeah.
If I were listening to this and I was someone who kept up with the news and maybe I've even seen a couple debates and a fairly, you know, reasonably well-informed citizen and I'm interested in this, but maybe I haven't obsessed over these questions to the extent that maybe you have.
I'd say good for you.
Right.
Like you're doing a good job.
One must live. One must live. But, you know, I might be wondering at this point, only 38% of the delegates have been picked in the Democratic primary, right? 38% of delegates are accounted for presently at the time
of
this recording.
And we should say, yeah, we're early March today. Yeah.
And, you know, actually the delegate count is really close, right? Biden's delegate lead is small, but I would say, though his delegate lead is small, it's very difficult to overcome. to my friends out there who are Bernie Sanders supporters, I try to explain this. Before Super Tuesday, there was something like a 63% chance that no one was going to win a majority of delegates going into the convention, whereas now there's something like an 87% chance that Joe Biden is going to win a majority of the delegates. And my question for you would be why?
It's mostly due to polling. And the polling, I think, aligns with, at this point, the profiles of the states that are left, because that matters. If you look at a map, if you look at a primary map from 2016 or a general election map from 2016, the choice of candidate, choice of president, it clusters. We could say that the Deep South tends to vote a certain way. We could say New England tends to vote a certain way. We could say the Rust Belt tends to vote a certain way. Of course, that's not universally true, but you know, you can notice patterns. And because of those patterns over recent history, you can make a fairly good educated guess about which states are going to vote which ways in both the general election and in the primary. And polling is used to support that. But, you know, the basic answer is the states that are left that haven't voted yet are more favorable. We have reason to expect them to be more friendly to Joe Biden.
An example, and we'll know the results, you know, by the time this airs, the results will be known. But at the time of this recording, the next delegate-rich state to weigh in the primary contest is Michigan. You know, Michigan will be voting, I mean, it's something like 10 to 8 states, I think, are going to be voting that day. But Michigan is the one that I think people are paying the most attention to because there's 125 delegates at stake, which is a fair amount. It's not California big. It's not Texas big. With Texas, it's more than 200 delegates. With California, it's more than 400.
Right.
But on that day, 125 delegates is a big deal. And as of right now, Biden leads in the polling, 29% to Sanders 23, which is a relatively significant advantage. That poll that I just referred to, in that same poll, Bloomberg is at 11%. It's fair, perhaps, to assume that many, if not most, of those Bloomberg polling voters, they may be interested in Biden. After all, Bloomberg endorsed Biden not so long ago. Warren, in that same poll, polls in Michigan at 7%. So there's a delegate math problem, I think, for Bernie Sanders. In terms of him coming up with a viable strategy, it's just more of an uphill struggle for him to get to a point where he's going to have a majority of the delegates. It's far less likely for him at this point.
Yeah, and I think there's states, including Alaska, actually, that at one point in the primary, after Nevada, when Bernie Sanders was looking like a strong front runner, when you could poll in Michigan, you could poll in Alaska, you could poll in a whole bunch of states, and Bernie Sanders would be in the lead.
Yeah.
I think that momentum matters too. Yeah. I think that when people want to vote for, people want to endorse a winner, people want to vote for a winner. There was definitely a point in time when Bernie Sanders was polling amongst Democratic candidates as, you know, the first choice among those Rust Belt states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, that seem like they will be a pivot point in the general election.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of attention focused on them. Yeah. In Alaska, Alaska votes on the 4th of April, on Saturday, April 4th. Up until a couple of weeks ago, Alaska, you know, there haven't, again, there's still, to my knowledge, there still haven't been any polls conducted around the state of Alaska. But based on the election modeling, which we've discussed here before, Alaska was something like 70 or 80% likely to vote for Bernie Sanders.
Yep.
And now, I pulled this today, so it may have changed since then. I don't think it would. It says the 538 model says that Biden is 70% likely to take the primary in Alaska.
I wonder if that's based upon polling information or if it's more just...
I think it's based on the results so far.
Right.
You're listening to a discussion between UA Press Director Nate Bauer and UAF Political Science Professor Alexander Hirsch. After this break, Alaska's upcoming primary. Welcome back. I'm talking this segment with Nate Bauer and Alexander Hirsch about the 2020 presidential race. Let's return to the conversation.
Any other final thoughts about the 4th?
Yeah, we've mentioned it here before that it's a change this year for Alaska that we're moving from a caucus to a primary, and we've talked about the differences between those. There are still some caucuses. You know, Nevada was a caucus, and a few of the Super Tuesday states were caucuses. But I guess I would just point out that participation rates in states that have moved from caucuses to primaries this year, Alaska's not the only one. There's a number of other states that have moved from caucuses to primaries. And it's been remarkable to track the participation rates and how dramatically they've moved up in those states that have switched. Colorado switched from a caucus to a primary, and they had a participation rate that went up over 500%. Maine was up over 300%. Minnesota was close to 300%, and Utah was up over 100%. So there are big, big differences. And, you know, a theme I think of these conversations so far has been the ways that different particular states of the 50 United States conduct their processes in order to find a nominee. They matter. And I think that we should look at those differences over history between the different states, and we should try and learn from those differences and from those changes.
I would say, this is polemical now, but I would say this. I agree that switching from a caucus to a primary increases participation, and I would say that's a very good thing. I think being inclusive and seeing people become more politically active and being put in a position where they can access collective decision-making, that those are all good core values of any aspiring democratic political society. And so I like to see that. On the other hand, I lament to some degree the potential loss of having a rich deliberative exercise. You know, with a caucus, you have this opportunity for people to defend their views and to enter into dialogue with one another and to enter into civic discourse. And of course, if the number of people who are engaged in that process isn't reflective of the overall number of people who have a stake in that exercise.
Or the demographics of the people.
Absolutely. Big problem. But for me, it'd be great if we could locate a means by which we could preserve that rich deliberative exercise and also be inclusive. For me, that's the ideal balance, because it's, for me, democracy isn't just about taking a cultural relativism poll. Like, you know, raise your hand if you like this candidate or like that candidate. For me, democracy is more robust. It requires conversation. It requires expression. It requires debate. And what I notice is that in our society, finding places where you can have rich, respectful, engaged debate, they're few and far between. I mean, you know, turning to the internet and to social media, you don't find that is...
You mean flame wars don't count?
Right, exactly. The world of emojis and
trolls. You
know, cyberbullying and trolls. Yeah, I don't think that is an adequate space for political communication. I think we can do better. And though the caucuses have a lot of problems, and I think you've identified them well, at the same time, I lament seeing these spaces go away for good reason, right? But I lament seeing them go away because it's an endangered species, you know, the authentic space of civic engagement. You know, instead, what we have are shopping malls where you're a private citizen pursuing your private interests. I would like to see our society engage in and invest in more authentic public spaces where disagreement and sometimes discord can find healthy outlets through an exchange of ideas. You know, I think the university is still a place where that happens. I think public radio is certainly a place where that happens.
Hear, hear.
And I think we need to find more spaces like that.
I'm talking right now with Nate Bauer, who heads the University of Alaska Press, and Alexander Hirsch, who's a political science professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Thanks, guys.
Thank you very
Thanks,
much,
Robert.
Links to Nate Bauer and the UA Press and UAF political scientist Alexander Hirsch are on the Northern Soundings website. When we return from the break, the U.S.'s sordid history with Iran. Listening to Northern Soundings, I'm Robert Hannon. Broadcast of Northern Soundings is made possible by listeners like you and support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks and Foundation Health Partners.
A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. We're in a transformed world as countries around the globe cope with the COVID-19 pandemic. One of the countries hardest hit has been Iran. The Middle Eastern country has been a bogeyman for the Trump administration, which unilaterally pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal and imposed new sanctions on the country. This led me to turn to UAF Professor Kerry DeWitt, who teaches geography. He says if you want an historical perspective, think in the thousands of years.
The leaders of Iran see Iran as rightfully being the dominant power in that region. There was a Persian Empire long before any of these other states existed. And that Persian cultural base and sort of sense of national identity is still there, you know, and it goes back a long way.
Right. And of course, Western powers kind of intervened and removed some leaders, put a Shah in, and then, of course, the Ayatollah Khomeini ousted the Shah and took Americans hostage. So for a lot of Americans who never gave Iran probably much thought, that was the first time on the world stage we really became aware of them.
That the American public really became aware of it.
Right.
That was certainly not the beginning of interactions between Iran and the U.S., sometimes in a rather positive sense. There was actually a constitutional revolution in 1906, established Iran's as one of the first real democracies in the Middle East. And one of the people who helped and supported the revolutionaries in trying to establish some kind of representative government instead of just being under the hands of a monarchy was an American missionary, and he became a hero. There's still a statue of him. And he took up arms and went into battle and was killed pretty much on the first day. So long way back, there was a really good feeling about Americans, the Iranian psyche. Fast forward through a little bit of history after that, what undid that essentially was that the British were very interested in oil. And Iran, one of the first large discoveries of oil was in Iran in 1908. And the British were in a position to sort of step up and work out a deal where they were essentially taking Iran's oil, giving them back a token part of the value of the oil. And the country was quite poor at that point and desperate for revenue. And so they weren't in a position really to drive a better bargain for themselves. That, of course, rankled people in Iran, and their democracy was developing. And eventually the parliament, you know, this parliament had been established after that revolution, and it was elected representatives. That parliament had, over time, gained more and more real political power. At first, the Shah sort of set it up as a gesture, but they were gaining influence. And there was one parliamentarian, his name was Mohammad Mossadegh, and he was actively trying to renegotiate a new deal with the British, which the British wanted nothing to do with. And yet he kept pushing. He went to the United Nations. He met with American government officials. All this was really, really irritating the British. And they concluded that what they had to do was get rid of him, especially he was eventually became prime minister. And that was sort of the last straw. And the British were scheming about how to basically get rid of him or overthrow the government, overthrow the parliament at least, get rid of the parliament so they could just deal directly with the Shah, who was easier to push around. And Mossadegh got wind of this plot by the British and shut down the British embassy and kicked all the British representatives out of Iran. Okay, so this is where the U.S. comes in. The Brits had lost their foothold in Iran. And so they went to the U.S. and they said, hey, can you get in there? Can you sneak in with your embassy assets and help us out? So this was in 1951 under the Truman administration. And Truman didn't see any good reason for doing this. He thought keeping Iran on good terms was a bolster against communism. You know, so in 1951, this is right in the middle of the Cold War. Fears about communism, and Iran shares a border with the Soviet Union, or did at that point. So Truman tried to work out a deal. He tried to talk to the Iranians, talk to the British, get the Iranians to sit down, negotiate with the British. All of his efforts failed, and his conclusion was it wasn't going to work. So he told the British, you're just going to have to live with this. And the British didn't especially like that, but the U.S. wasn't going to help. Okay, so that was 1951. In 1953, there had been an election, and Eisenhower was in office. So he was president. He brought in a new cabinet. Among the people in his cabinet were the Dulles brothers, one of whom was Secretary of State and one of whom was the head of the CIA. And the Dulles brothers had previously worked for a law firm that represented Standard Oil. And Standard Oil had been wanting to get into Iran for a long time. And the British had a lock on all of the oil resources in Iran and wasn't letting anybody else in. Okay, so the British still wanted help. They were appealing to Eisenhower. The Dulles brothers saw several opportunities. One was, hey, maybe we can get our hands on that oil. Another was, this would be a big public relations win for the U.S. as far as fighting communism, because they had identified a party that held some seats in the Iranian parliament that called itself a communist group. And so they tried to paint Mossadegh as being communist because this party supported his party. So it would be a win against communism without having to go really face-to-face with Russia or China, but be able to declare a victory.
So bragging points, as it were, that they had somehow overthrown a communist regime, or at least a body riddled with communists.
Yes. So they did. They engineered a coup, and there's a really interesting character in here. He was head of that branch of the CIA that kind of dealt with things in the Middle East. And his name was Kermit Roosevelt, grandson of Theodore. And he looks completely harmless, but he was an amazing spy. And some people think that James Bond was partially based on him, actually.
No kidding.
What it turned out that Iran at many levels was very corrupt. And with enough money, you could essentially buy a lot of help from political leaders. He had most of the press outlets in Iran on his payroll, and they were printing anti-Mossadegh articles accusing him of being anything that sounded bad. So he was anti-democratic, he was anti-Muslim, he was a communist, and the military also was up for hire if you had enough money. And even some of the Muslim clergy who had authority and ability to persuade people as speakers and leaders were available for hire to, he found the right ones who would take bribes and essentially create this image of Mossadegh as being some kind of sinister figure. And a lot of this was actually aimed at the Shah to try to get the Shah to turn against Mossadegh. And the Shah and Mossadegh had worked together for a long time, so he wasn't easily convinced. But Kermit Roosevelt eventually, through a series of personal meetings with the Shah, convinced him to support a plot to overthrow Mossadegh. I think it's to the Shah's credit. He was very reluctant because they tried all kinds of sneaky ways of they bribed his sister to implore him, and that didn't work. But Kermit Roosevelt, again, he must have been quite a guy, because here's this American CIA agent who somehow convinces the monarch of this foreign country that he needs to throw out his prime minister. So that meant they had the army on their side and the local police in Tehran on their side, and the plan was to just go and seize him from his house and accuse him of a bunch of things and throw him in jail. But Mossadegh heard about this, and he lined up his own faction of security forces who then popped out of the bushes and arrested the security forces that had been sent to arrest him. And then he went on the radio and announced he had foiled this coup. And people were cheering in the streets and defending their leader. As soon as that first coup failed, the Shah fled because he was afraid, you know, Mossadegh would come after him.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. I'm talking this segment to UAEF geographer Kerry DeWitt about Iran. When we return from the break, never giving up on undermining a government. Welcome back to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm talking this segment with UAF geographer Kerry DeWitt. Before the break, Kerry was describing a failed CIA plot to overthrow the Iranian prime minister. Let's get back to the discussion.
So he announces that he's foiled the coup. What happened next?
Well, Kermit Roosevelt reported back to his superiors in Washington, and they said, oh, well, I guess you win some, you lose some. Come on back home. And Roosevelt defied those instructions, decided that there was still something he could do. And he still had access to a lot of money. And what he did was he hired thugs. There basically was something like organized crime organizations in Tehran, and there were the muscle part of them who could be hired to go and cause trouble. So he hired them to essentially start riots in the street and smash windows, set fire to things, attack people, all while they were chanting their devotion to Mossadegh and creating this image that supporters of Mossadegh were a bunch of dangerous thugs. Then he hired a whole another bunch of thugs to attack and fight the thugs that he had hired to talk about supporting Mossadegh. And neither group knew that they were under the pay of the same guy, but they were fighting in the streets. And so it was just chaos in the streets of Tehran. And then he started having his friends in the media put out pleas for the Shah to return. So these mobs are fighting in the street and the media is putting out pleas for the Shah to come back and restore order. So now the story they were telling was that this is all happening because the Shah is gone and Mossadegh can't keep the country under control, and the only answer is to bring the Shah back. Eventually, some army officials that Kermit Roosevelt had had in on this plot stepped in to restore order and declare that the Shah was the rightful leader of Iran, and the Shah returned. Maybe the younger generation isn't so aware of this, but the previous generation, they all knew this history of essentially their country having been on a path to a democratic system and it having been undone by this American plot. So before the 1979 revolution, the sentiment in Iran toward Americans was never that warm since 1953. Actually, a lot of the way things played out in 1979 went that way because they suspected that the United States was going to do the same thing. And so various actions that the United States took, for instance, when the 1979 revolution happened, the Shah took refuge in the United States, eventually because he was suffering from cancer. And at first, the U.S. didn't want to let him in because of the political implications. They didn't want to take a side, basically. But they eventually let him in under President Carter. He decided for humanitarian reasons. And he tried to make clear that this is strictly for humanitarian reasons. We're letting the Shah in so that he can get good medical care. But back in Iran, that was immediately interpreted as part of an American plot to eventually try to reinstall the Shah. Let's see, there were also some diplomatic meetings between American and Iranian officials that, again, just fed into that assumption.
And it was a religious state after that, wasn't it? A quasi-religious
yes.
state? And I know there's Sunni and Shiite differences in the region as well, and that seems to have played a role in some of the agitation taking place. Didn't Saddam Hussein launch a war against them? And,
yes.
And there was a long kind of conflict there?
Yes. So, you know, immediately after that revolution, things were in turmoil. There were all of a sudden embargoes against Iran by Western countries. They were having a hard time selling their oil, so they were economically disadvantaged. Politically, they were still trying to stabilize the new government. And Saddam Hussein thought this was a good opportunity to hop across the border and seize some territory, and some of the territory that had the best oil wells in Iran,
mm-hmm.
and some of its best agricultural land, and really, really the most valuable part of Iran is just right next door to Iraq. And the Sunni-Shia thing is part of it because Iran is mostly Shia Muslim. Iraq is mostly Sunni. So Saddam Hussein decided to invade, and Iran, even though it lacked very good military resources and money, they fought back quite fiercely with a lot of bodies. They used what they call human wave tactics, in which sometimes completely unarmed crowds of people would just rush Iraqi tanks and overwhelm them. And of course, you know, a tank and people with machine guns have a certain sort of an advantage, but if enough people are coming at you, they can eventually get through. And of course, there's tremendous loss of life. It is estimated somewhere around 1 million Iranians lost their lives.
Wow.
And quite a few Iraqis too. Yeah. Mm. That also ties back to that deep sense of national identity that Iranians have. When they feel like their country is attacked, they have a sense of identity there that they're willing to defend with their lives. And that makes them a pretty tough enemy, even if they're outgunned.
Now, moving the calendar up a bit is, of course, their nuclear capability. Then, of course, Iran has been instrumental in a kind of a proxy conflict, supporting factions in Syria and Lebanon, and they're trying to establish some influence in the region through these groups?
Yes. So an interesting thing about whether Iran gets nuclear weapons, there are a lot of basic unquestioned assumptions about how the U.S. should deal with Iran and getting a nuclear weapon. And some of those are that its intentions are to threaten the United States or other Western powers or something like that. My sense of what that is about, if it can get its nuclear armed, it will, in fact, become the dominant power in that region because they will simply have to be respected by Saudi Arabia and the other countries that might vie for influence. The second thing is they realize that the only real way to protect themselves from being attacked by, say, Israel or the United States is to have their own nuclear weapons because they have a deterrent. So I don't think the leadership of Iran is out to attack somebody else. I think what they want is the sort of political clout that comes with having nuclear weapons. So the spreading of fear about how we're going to be vulnerable or attacked or something like that, I think that's overblown. The thing that's worrisome about it is that if Iran does get nuclear weapons, then Saudi Arabia will be very motivated to get its own. And if Saudi Arabia gets them, then maybe you'll see Egypt wanting to get them and the whole thing starting to ramp up into a new nuclear arms race that involves lots of countries. Countries don't necessarily have all the checks and balances in place to
accidentally or intentionally
people from pushing the button.
I'm talking this segment to UAF geographer Kerry DeWitt about Iran. When we return from the break, nuclear weapons in the Middle East. This is Northern Soundings. To Northern Soundings Alaska in Conversation. I'm talking this segment with UAF geographer Kerry DeWitt about Iran and nuclear arms. Let's get back to the discussion.
And Israel is the only country that we know of that currently has nuclear weapons, right?
Correct. And in opposition to all of the agreements about nuclear weapons, they don't happen to have signed on to the international agreement about limiting weapons, and they actually officially will not admit that they have them. And Iran knows they have them, and they see that as being important to protect themselves from being attacked.
So one of the other complicating factors is this proxy war that seems to be, or conflicts that arise as Iran supports these militias or militant groups.
Iran has found that it cannot directly throw its weight around. It can support these smaller proxy groups. So Hezbollah carried out the attack on the army barracks in Beirut in 1983, I think, which was an enormous blow against the United States, but without it being a direct confrontation. So for relatively little investment and little risk, they managed to strike a substantial blow that did, in fact, end up in the United States withdrawing its troops from
Lebanon.
So that's a tactic that has worked, and they continue to use that. you know, those tankers that were attacked in the Strait of Hormuz over the summer, there's a lot of assumption that those were carried out by Iran. It would be very consistent with that style of doing things, sort of harassing, but in a way that allows them to deny connections. Although I don't want to reinforce a conclusion that Iran actually carried out those attacks, because the evidence never seems to quite coalesce to support the immediate claims that are made, especially by the American administration, that everything is clearly Iran's fault.
And finally, I guess as we go forward in this troubled region, what's the current political makeup of Iran?
Well, first of all, the Iranian government is not a unified monolith. There are factions within it that are pulling in one direction or another. And so the things that come out of Iran, the decisions and actions, sometimes are because one party has gained the upper hand and sometimes the other. So the basic split is that there's extremely conservative faction that doesn't trust Westerners, doesn't trust the U.S. They were against the Iran nuclear deal that was negotiated between Iran, the U.S., and about four other countries. They see no reason for any of these negotiations or compromises. And when the other side is a moderate side that wants to normalize relations with the international community, get out of their sort of pariah status, and they see ways of doing that is to become more politically moderate, become more willing to negotiate and compromise. So that more moderate group had the upper hand while the Obama administration was in office, and they were open to negotiating to work out that nuclear deal. And the conservative faction didn't want to see that happen, but they sort of were overruled, and they felt that the United States can't be trusted. You can make a deal with them, they're going to stab you in the back, et cetera. So the Trump administration came in and pretty quickly announced they were going to withdraw from that agreement. And the effect that had domestically in Iranian politics was to reinforce the conservatives' viewpoint. They could stand up and say, see, we told you so.
So harden the lines now. And all these sanctions have really put a economic kibosh on the country.
Yes. And when those sanctions happen, it only strengthens the hardliners, because they can say, see what happens when you work with the West. And then if the economic situation leads to protests, people are saying, hey, you know, we don't have jobs, we don't have resources, our electricity isn't on, things like that. Then the hardliners call in their security forces to deal with the protesters, are sort of more justified, or use that to justify declaring extreme measures to keep things under control and therefore do away with some of the few democratic rights that people do have. So that doesn't help. You know, when I was talking about the political split, a third interesting component is that the people of Iran, for the most part, want democracy. When the revolution happened in 1979, that actually followed a series of protests that had been going on against the Shah because they wanted democracy. They were tired of being ruled by this autocrat, and they thought they were going to get a democracy. That's what the Iranian people wanted. When Ayatollah Khomeini came back, because he'd been in exile in France, his return was celebrated and he had some loyal supporters. But the general population had no idea that what they were seeing was someone coming in to take over the country and turn it into a religious republic. So when we talk about what does Iran want, or what are Iran's intentions, and can we trust Iran, and so on, the political leaders are one thing. The people are entirely another thing. And the opportunity for Iran to sort of reform and become more moderate has presented itself a number of times. And unfortunately, it tends to be in a situation where the U.S. officials, for one reason or another, decide they don't want to extend a hand. So shortly after the September 11 attacks, Iran actually extended a lot of offers to help with allowing the U.S. to use their airspace, offering to rescue downed pilots. And it's sort of a gesture of, hey, maybe we can start being friendly to each other. And unfortunately, there were factions within the Bush administration who were out to depose the Iranian government, and they didn't want to see any kind of relaxation of the U.S. stance toward Iran, so they ignored that. And the Iran nuclear deal was another, actually an astonishing accomplishment in diplomacy. Amazing, really. And then the Trump administration came in with a chip on their shoulder about that and just tossed it.
Scuttled it, yep.
And you know, they were complying with the deal. It was working. It was doing what it was intended to do, which was to close down their potential for nuclear weapons development. And now they're talking about getting back to it, sort of making moves in that direction, I think, as kind of a play to push the rest of the world into engaging with them again, because the sanctions are really hurting them. Again, I don't think it's because they want to make a bomb and blow up the United States.
I'm talking right now to Kerry DeWitt. He's associate professor of geography at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he comes in periodically to help us look at some tension points in the globe geopolitically. Kerry, we'll see you soon.
Thanks, Robert.
Links to Kerry DeWitt and the UAF Geography Department are on the Northern Soundings website. When we return from the break, tuxes and bikinis and cachexia clippings. Here's Chris.
Not too long ago, in what has accidentally become an annual ritual, I was rereading Wilkie Collins' proto-mystery novel, The Moonstone, and this sentence made my word whiskers twitch. Mrs. Yolland dived into this rubbish and brought up an old, japanned tin case. I was hesitant to look up that word japanned, fearing it would turn out to be an example of simple, casual racism in a book that, for its time, hinted a surprisingly nuanced view of race and colonialism in Victorian England. In this case, my fears were groundless. Japanned does indeed derive from the name of the country, but in a positive, or at worst, neutral way. In addition to being the place name, Japan is also a noun referring to an exceptionally hard, black, glossy varnish that originated there, and objects to which this varnish has been applied are said to have been japanned. Exceptionally dedicated listeners, I know using the plural here is delusional, might remember from the show about marathons that words like this, derived from the name of a place, are a kind of toponym, or more precisely, you might think of them as second-degree toponyms being derived from place names, which are themselves toponyms. So the word tangerine is a toponym derived from the Moroccan seaport of Tangiers, also a toponym, from which the delicious fruits were first commonly shipped. Toponyms of the second degree are sprinkled throughout English, some more obviously connected to their geographic parents than others. But even then, the details can be surprising. For example, thanks to the infamous nuclear test that took place there, I supposed bikinis were named after the Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands, but I wrongly assumed the word was based on some kind of dress worn by the islanders there, when it actually originated as a comparison between the shocking sight of the nuclear explosions and the effects of the scanty seaside garments on the people who witnessed them. But other toponyms hide in plain sight, happy, occasionally intertwined surprises waiting to be found by word lovers. Parchment, a writing material traditionally made from the stretched and dried skin of goats, sheep, or calves, but now used to describe various wood pulp-based papers at your local office warehouse, is a blend of the Latin toponym pergamena, because most parchment was made in the ancient Greek city of Pergamum, and Parthica pellis, Parthian leather, another toponym, this time named for the vast ancient Mediterranean Empire. And remember how Japan is a kind of varnish? As it happens, varnish is itself a toponym, coming by linguistic hook and crook from the ancient Egyptian city of Berenice or Berenike. If you could travel back in time to that prosperous city of Berenice in the times of the Roman Empire, you'd have found a temple or a palace there. And palace is another toponym, from the Latin palladium, the Palatine Hill, one of the seven hills of ancient Rome, on which was built the original palace, Caesar's house, and later Nero's vast, unfinished palace that occupied more than a square mile of space on the Palatine Hill before being razed and filled in by his embarrassed successors. Still at the Nero-esque end of the spectrum, at least in self-identified worth, the coach and coach bags ultimately comes from the small Hungarian town of Kocs, K-O-C-S, where the four-wheeled carriages of the same name were first produced. Other toponyms are considerably less grand, such as bungalows, those small, single-storied, expensive houses on the California coast, named after the Hindi Bangla, literally Bengalese, which were low thatched houses. Man-made materials are often toponyms for the obvious reason that they have to come to prominence somewhere. Toponyms of this sort are second to number only to food and drink, champagne, Dijon mustard, hollandaise sauce, and so on, but with connections that are often less obvious. The duffel and the humble duffel bag comes from the Belgian town of Duffel, where the rough woolen cloth from which the popular bags were made was first sold. Paisley, the teardrop pattern textile seen on scarves, ties, and waistcoats today, and in some painful 60s fashions, is named after the town of Paisley in the Scottish lowlands, and the tuxedo, in its Paisley incarnation, one of the 60s fashion faux pas I was thinking about, takes its name after Tuxedo Park, home to a country club where the dapper garment was popularized in the late 1800s. For more on toponyms, including examples I couldn't fit into today's segment, links to previous Toponym Forward shows about marathons and onomastics, or to re-listen to this or any other Cotexic Word segment, unpack that paisley bikini from your duffel bag and surf on over to cotexic.com/KUAC.
That's it for this show. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. We'll see you next time for Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. Thanks for listening.